evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned in the next hour for a great show. I'll start out with Libby Riddles here in the studio. She was the first woman to win the Iditarod Sled Dog Race in Alaska in 1985. Stay tuned for her bio in a few minutes. And in the second half of the show, I'll be laughing and chatting with Colette Costa about her unique contributions to Juneau and all of Southeast Alaska, with everything from the Boardwalk Boogie to Costa's Diner and her role at Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater here in Juneau. Reminder to listeners, you can find the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. Just go onto Facebook, type in the show name, like the project, and every week there are new updates on who's going to be on my show, and as well as the links to the recordings. You can follow the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project, and you can also go on my blog, adriennechile.blogspot.com, and there you find pictures as well as some of the recordings of my guests. Libby did it. This was the headline plastered across the front page of the Anchorage Times. On Wednesday, March 20, 1985, Libby Riddles made history. She became the first woman to win the grueling 1,049-mile Iditarod sled dog race after a daring move across Norton Sound in a deadly blizzard. In addition to her victory, she was named the 1985 Sportswoman of the Year by the Women's Sports Foundation and honored by the Iditarod Veterinarians with the 1985 Leonard Apala Humanitarian Award for her humane treatment of her dogs. Today, Riddles continues to breed and train sled dogs. When she's not training, she's promoting her favorite sport, inspiring others, or writing. She has three books, Race Across Alaska, Danger the Dogyard Cat, and Storm Run. In the spring of 93, she was hired as the sled dog coordinator for Steven Seagal movie On Deadly Ground, which was filmed in Alaska. And this added already to her extensive television and film experiences, which has involved working with many, many places, HBO, ESPN, NFL Films, and other Alaska television stations. She was born in Madison, Wisconsin, grew up in Washington State and Minnesota, and moved to Alaska at the age of 16. She homesteaded in a remote area of western Alaska and lived for 6 years in an Inupiat village in northern Alaska. She's currently in Homer and still has kennels with 28 dogs. Wow.
Just 28.
Wow, Libby. Well, thanks for coming on the show tonight. Welcome. Actually, she's one of my final guests. Even though I'm not ending the show, I am ending it for a little while as I relocate.
Well, I'm honored.
Thank you. Welcome. That's just a side note. But let's first start about not going back to 1985, but talking about the present and your role here in Juneau. Maybe not a lot of people know you live here in the summers. What brought you here, and what are you working on right now?
Well, the first thing that brought me to Juneau was seasonal employment, because dog mushers love seasonal employment. We can work all summer and then have the winters with the dogs. And I've done that off and on for years. You know, I've almost been in Alaska 40 years now, and that's kind of how I started out. So, I came up in the mid-90s and helped start the very first sled dog camp up on the ice field. Was the first one to call it heli mushing, I think.
I've never heard that term.
Yes, and, did that for 3 years. But it's pretty intense, and I figured with my skin, I'd probably have skin cancer after being up there for more than that, too. The sunburn you could get up there, just incredible. But what a beautiful place. So that got me going to where now I've got my own kind of a arrangement with Princess Cruises, and I do all these shows. Like when I was racing, I used to have my little camera right down here where I could get it down the front of my jacket, and I'd be racing and kicking, and then I'd be pulling out my camera and taking pictures the same time.
Nice.
And the other mushers would kind of make fun of me for doing this, but this is what I'm making my living with now, you know, and I put together a really nice slideshow. And you know, over the years, everybody writes to me and they ask me all these questions. So I know the questions they want to know and try to condense all the answers into this nice show. And then it goes very well most of the people that come to my show on Princess, they're going to go dog mushing to one of the summer camp tours or the ice field tours, the heli mushing. Or go see Jeff King up at Denali if they're doing the land tour, or Fairbanks, Riverboat Discovery, Lance Mackey, everybody. It's so funny. Yeah. We're all on this network doing these summer tours, and Juneau's the hotspot.
Because there's so many cruise ship passengers through here.
Yes, that's true. And it's kind of funny because Juneau's not exactly famous for sled dogs, but there's probably over 1,000 sled dogs on the ice around town here, you know?
Wow.
And plus with the summer camps, I ran into some of the Mendenhall Mushers today, and they've got like 230 dogs up there, or maybe 280 or something.
Wow.
That's just one camp.
And so, have most of those dogs raced before, or are they
more? A lot of them. Martin Booster has dogs up there. A lot of racers have dogs up there because it keeps them in shape all summer.
Mm-hmm.
They're very well socialized, you know, being around these people. They kind of know everything. No, and the mushers love it because somebody else is paying for the dog food. They get to run dogs all summer. And,
what a great deal.
It is just so much fun, I have to admit, to turn around and see somebody's humongous smile because they're mushing dogs in Alaska, you know, and... You know, I mean, I've done this for years, and it just kind of reminded me when I was doing it how cool it is that we're getting to do it, you know, when you see somebody else have that experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a lot of people, it just makes their whole trip to Alaska, you know, the dog connection.
Great. And so do you think a lot of these cruise passengers get on the boat having this idea in mind of going to your talk and then mushing as a tour, or do they get on the boat and... See, it's an option.
I'm sure it's different for some folks. Yeah. Some folks are looking at it ahead of time for sure, though. And I know Princess features me in some of their brochures and as well as the other, you know, dog mushing tours. So, you know, you have some people that come specifically to Alaska planning on doing that and others that might just kind of decide probably as they go along, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the whole summer camp tour kind of developed because people would book that heli mushing tour and then just be devastated because the weather was down and they couldn't fly up there. You know, so this way, if the weather's looking not so great, they can go do the, you know, wheel rig ride in the rain. You know, that's fine.
And that's a closer option instead of going up on the ice field.
Exactly. It's less expensive for the customer, and then it's, accessible by road, you know, and buses instead of the helicopter. Mm-hmm. But you don't get to see all the ice field and all that. But, again, you know, on days when they're not flying, you know, they can do that.
Yeah. So you feel welcomed in the Juneau community?
Yeah. I know. Yeah, no, I love Juneau.
You got to spend your summers here for a while.
It's just so crazy doing the seasonal lifestyle, though. In Homer, like, I have such a quiet winter in Homer for the most part. I mean, I do a little traveling, but... I mean, Homer's 5,000 people. If I go down to town, I'm generally trying to get back before the rush hour in Homer. So I come to Juneau and think this place is huge. And then, you know, I'll work with people on the ships that are from places like Mexico City, and they think it's hysterical that I think Juneau's a big old city, you know. But it's a fun change, though, especially it just takes a little bit of adapting every year. And, I've got to move for 5 months to be here and find house sitters and, you know, but – can't complain. Half the town's like that in the summer, I guess, right?
Yeah. And has Alaska Airlines gotten used to shipping dogs around the state, I imagine?
Oh, they do, but most people drive them down and take the ferry. For sure, yeah, because they have the dog trucks and, you know, that whole thing, yeah.
Nice, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So dogs and dog mushing, let's go back to 1985. You're the first woman to win the Iditarod. Is that... a race that you can still visualize in your mind? Are those details pretty clear
as you go back to the... I see the slideshow about it every day,
besides the pictures.
Well, of course, you know, and then being a writer, you kind of have a memory for those kind of details. And, you know, I'm trying to do some writing still, although I admit I'm kind of a lazy writer. But what I've been trying to do is, like, transcribe old journals and get them on a computer so I can organize stuff and...
Okay.
It's kind of interesting.
So you kept journals of every trip?
Yeah. I recommend everybody doing anything exciting does that because it's just cool to, you know, look back 20 years and go, I was doing that? Cool. I was going 35 miles with four dogs. Amazing. You know? That's kind of how I started out. But.
Wow. So when you think back, there's this thing in your bio that talks about going across Norton Sound and you made a move. What was this decision that was a last-minute move in that race that I'm guessing let you win?
Well, you know, that coast of Alaska, it's kind of famous for the ground storms. And, you know, I had raced the Iditarod twice. I'd raced in 80 and 81. I had come in 18th place out of almost 60 mushers in 1980. And then I raced in 81. And was actually 2 days faster than my race the year before, but I placed 20th instead of 18th. And I was doing it mostly with dogs that are were borrowed or, you know, like older dogs that were experienced and stuff that I hadn't raised myself. So after I raced twice, I figured I knew what I wanted enough as far as what I wanted to breed, you know, as far as close to my ideal for the Iditarod dog. So I kind of on purpose took a little break from racing while I bred dogs, raised these puppies, And in the process, I had just loved Northwestern Alaska so much, I worked my way up there. And yeah. I started as a fish buyer, and I ended up in Teller working together with Joe Garney. And we put together, you know, we had a partnership where he'd race the Iditarod 1 year, and I'd race the next year. Like, he took their dogs on their maiden Iditarod voyage and came in third place
really?
In 1984 with this dog team that I had. So the pressure was on me, knowing that I had a team that was third place already at a year and a half old, when I raced it the next year, thinking, okay, the dog team's good. What can Miss Riddles do here, you know? And I went into that race knowing that I had been working for it for 4 years. And believe me, it's like the Olympics, you know, when you know you have that much work into something day after day, working as hard as you can, trying to give the dogs all those kinds of experiences. I mean, if it was blizzarding in Teller and nobody's even peeking their head out of their house, I'm going dog mushing because that's practice for the Iditarod, you know. And sometimes they'd turn around, they'd drag me back to the house, and I'd make them go out again, you know? Because
really?
It's like, hey, guys, this could happen on the Iditarod. So they were used to that. The pups grew up like that. When you raise dogs in a forest, their heads, they can't handle the wind in their heads,
oh,
you know,
wow.
unless they've had that. So anyway, I think I was kind of prepared for it when it happened, and I positioned myself well in the front of the race, the front few mushers. And it was a funny race because they had a few holdups. The weather was so bad going on the mountain pass that the pilots weren't able to get our food over to the other side of the mountains. So even if mushers wanted to try to go through the mountain pass, there would be no dog food waiting for us.
Oh, man.
So they held the race up for 3 days and then had like a restart. And then that happened again up the trail. But you know, so it kind of created some kind of an imbalance, but it worked out good for me at least anyway. And I just, you know, and Joe had helped train the team. We worked together on it. They'd done the Cusco that year. You know, and so it was a pretty good dog team for sure. And I just had no doubt that they could handle the storm. You know, I've been out in storms like that with teams I wasn't quite so sure of before, since then, you know. So, we just had to be really careful and, trust the dogs that they were going the right way because we had to work together. I mean, sometimes I would have to actually walk out ahead of the dogs to find the markers, and then I'd walk back to my dogs and mush them up to the markers. So, but that way you're going to not get lost because if you get lost and off that trail, people die out there every year. I mean, there's open leads. There was one section where there wasn't any trail markers, and the reason for that was that the ice had gone out and taken the markers with it, and then we frozen over that. So that's where I used Joe Garney's old leader, and I don't know how she found it, but in fact, I thought she was going the wrong way, and I started yelling at her, and she found the markers and got me over there. It was pretty much the only time I used her in lead the whole race, but she really saved the day there. She was the old smart dog in the team, you know?
Wow.
But
is there an average lifespan? Not lifespan, but Iditarod span of 20-year dogs on average?
Oh,
they
with
go
the
for
dogs,
five
these,
Iditarods.
They race really well. My first Iditarod team, I had 5 10-year-olds in there. They were from Jerry Riley's winning team. They knew 3 times more than I did.
So the dogs lead the person, really.
Well, they age really well. They really do, these dogs. They, if you retire them at 10, they're training puppies and you know, still running usually till at least 14 or so, at least short distance.
So would you name some of them? Did you have different ways you would name them?
Oh, it's
Alaska
I like
names.
Having kind of creative names. I don't know, like I learned from one of the best, I think, Rod Perry. He used to always have some really good dog names like Lugnut and Crazy Legs and Fat Albert and, you know, and I've had some fun with my one dog, Inca, that was on my winning team because every litter that came out of Inca, I'd have to have a few I names. So there was Indy and Ida and Iris and Indigo, but then we also have like Icky Bug and Ice Worm and some of those. But, you know, you have to find kind of fun names, but they have to fit the dog too. Huh. Some mushers that breed a lot of dogs have kind of themes, you know, like the name of them all after presidents or I remember a friend of mine, we want them to eat like vacuum cleaners. So my friend Rudder named hers all after vacuum cleaners. So
wow.
Like Kirby and Hoover and all this stuff, you know.
That's fun, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. Now, is there a difference between male and female dog? A team is made up of a mix of both, or?
Yeah, the leaders are all female.
Are they?
Huh. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. I'm like, that's great. I don't know much about dog machines.
There's a bus driver in town that tells everybody that, and I thought it was funny. So.
Well, you could have said that, and everybody would think that's true.
I couldn't let it go, sorry.
Yeah, could be people listening.
No, you know, we both, mostly, I think most mushers use both, you know. Some people prefer bigger males. Sometimes the speed mushers prefer female dogs because they tend to mature earlier and they're smaller, which is sometimes what the sprint mushers are looking for. But I've always had like half and half, you know.
About half and half. Mm-hmm. And this other little piece about the treating dogs humanely or recognized for that, are there people out there or mushers that don't treat their dogs very well?
There are people that don't treat their kids well.
Well, yeah,
of course,
I know,
there's going to be
know.
People that don't treat their dogs well.
But that actually raise them and need it or not, isn't there a standard that you have to live up to?
Of course there is, and that's, you know, and that's why they have vets, they have officials. But, you know, I mean, there's always that potential. But I think people don't realize maybe, too, with these huskies, it's real different than a lot of different kinds of dogs that most people are more familiar with. And they have a very strong survival instinct. And if they're not having fun, they will lay down and quit on you at the most inopportune time. So I think that people that have been in this a long time, you know, you're seeing something of the connection with their dogs. And most of us, you know, we sacrifice so much to be able to have this lifestyle. And it's so much work. You'd have to be out of your head to be doing this and not having fun with it to that extent, you know?
Yeah. Huh. Well, so jumping around here, you mentioned that you'd listened to Dave Hunsicker's interview, which was a great one a few weeks ago. You were a sled dog coordinator for the Steven Seagal movie, which was filmed in my hometown of Valdez. And you've had kind of this relationship with L.A. and movies and film. Any exciting projects that you've worked on specifically? Or you said Dave and you had worked together as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just like the typical old-time Alaska. You've got your hands in about five different pies, right, you know? And, you know, we've tried to option the rights for my story several times and had it written up as treatments. But like Dave himself says, it's only an X amount of percentage that actually ever sees it to the screen, you know? But it's a good story, so I'm not giving up that it might end up on screen someday. But if it does, I want it done right. And somebody like Dave, of course, would do it justice, you know, as opposed to like maybe a out-of-state writer or somebody that doesn't really have the feeling for it. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. And doing commercials has been kind of a fun challenge. You know, I used to do some for Anchorage Chrysler Dodge, you know, because they support the Iditarod. And doing the film, the Seagal film with Warner Brothers was kind of interesting. It's like, okay, how do we do this scene and make it happen? And
was it a scene shot in Valdez or did you have to go to L.A.?
We were there for weeks in Valdez, working in Thompson Pass. And, you know, you couldn't keep dogs in Valdez, so we were camped up at Saina Lodge. And
why couldn't you?
Because they don't.
Town?
You can't. You have to have a license to have more than three dogs in Valdez,
really?
I think.
Oh,
it's not
that.
A dog town. No, But up in the pass up there, we would have worked up there for free. My friends and I, we were having so much fun. You know, it's like May, beautiful snow and sun, and we're running dogs and getting paid for it. Are you kidding me? But for me, it was a learning curve as far as, okay, how much do you charge Warner Brothers for renting a six-dog team? And how much do you charge for this big, nice sled of yours they're going to spray over with this and that? And, you know, so I had to, you know, I talked with Bob Crockett, who's working with the film industry all the time, and called friends of mine and try to, you know, figure out those kind of logistics. But
yeah,
it's fun. I mean, it's been really fun, the opportunities I've had since I've won the Iditarod and learning how to do some of this other kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, the movie, going back to that movie, they shoot a lot probably. And then when you finally saw the movie, what was the final?
The movie was
horrible. I never saw it. It was horrible.
I knew it was horrible.
So I didn't watch it.
But
did
the
you
dogs
appear at all?
Really cool.
Did they?
No, I didn't appear in it because the friends of mine that were dog wranglers had to stunt double for Eskimos. I don't think I could do that, really. And my friend Larry Williams, he actually did an article in the We Alaskans. They used to have at ADN. And it was funny. He called it On Sweaty Ground because he was up on 60 degrees on the ice field having to wear a full reindeer suit. I mean, he was so hot, we were making him ice packs of Ziploc bags, you know. But
on sweaty ground, that's okay.
Yeah, but anyway, that was kind of a fun, I don't know, that was really a neat experience. And working for Warner Brothers, you know, so professional. And I've worked with, like, Steve Groeschel, who's up there at Haynes, that has the wildlife photo thing and the Wolverine. He's the Wolverine guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Very cool.
I'll have to try to get him on.
Yeah,
the
sure.
Wolverine guy.
Yeah, he is good. Yeah.
Huh. Wow. So is there anything, like, other experience in the film area that you'd like to have? Or what about theater? Has anybody ever thought about adapting it?
Oh, no. I don't know about theater. I don't know. I mean, mostly what I'm doing really more and what I'm focusing on instead of film, I think, really is more, you know, just doing presentations and speaking for, like, corporations and conventions and at colleges. And I really enjoy doing that. I'm kind of my own agent for that. I don't advertise it enough probably, but it goes word of mouth very well. And it's, I don't know, I just, it's really kind of amazing. I mean, I used to, years ago, just be scared to death to talk in front of people. And over the years, I've gotten actually pretty good at it and enjoy it. You know, I really do enjoy it. You know, I like, you know, even with the people that come here in the summer, you know, like, I feel like I'm giving them an honest piece of what our culture is, you know, and trying to really explain what this whole dog culture is for us. And you know, leave them with a little bit of information about what the real life is up here, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, do you have a specific message? I know you do motivational speaking as well. Do you relate kind of your experience dog mushing to larger life lessons at all?
Well, I think just the lifestyle that we have with it in itself, you know, pertains to the fact that, you know, in Alaska, we respect people that work hard, you know, and that are innovative. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of appeal to their connection with the animals because that's the thing we all have in common, mm-hmm. you know. And it's just, it's really fascinating to me, all the angles of, like, I continue, like, to learn more about the connection between especially dogs and humans and how we co-evolved. You know, I want to kind of let them know a little bit about these particular dogs that we use and what the mushers are like. But I don't know, it's kind of a win-win for everybody, you know, and it gives me a venue to sell my books. And then aside from my books, I sell a lot of things from my musher friends, you know, some, you know, like Jeff Schultz's photo books. And I'm selling, you know, handmade little Christmas ornaments from friends of mine, nice. Starving artist type that make their living that way. And,
very cool.
You know, I don't know, I enjoy it.
So what's the farthest place you've traveled? Around the United States, internationally, for the speaking engagements, corporate?
Oh, usually it's within the country.
Okay.
Florida is kind of a long way to go.
Yeah, it is. But,
yeah, I've been over to there. And yeah, I mean, I probably could do more international, but, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of long-distance flying.
No?
No, I'd barely much rather work just in-state if I could, you know. So I try to hit conventions that are coming to Anchorage and, you know, things like that.
Mm. But, well, traveling Alaska can be like international.
Well,
if you go to Adak, it's pretty far.
Yeah, from Juneau to Homer feels like international. It's like two flights.
So. Yeah. So books as well, you're pushing your books. Not all three of your books are kids' books, are they?
Names of them. No. There's one for adults as well. And
Race Across Alaska, that's the...
Yeah, for adults.
For adults, okay.
And that's been, like, translated into Italian. And
oh, really?
It was on the American Library Association's best books when it came out. And, and then the kids' books, I worked together with Shelley Gill. She was one of the first women to ever finish the Iditarod. And she started her own publishing company to publish this book that she wrote about her lead dog when she ran the Iditarod in the late 70s. So... we worked together in these books, and then Shannon Cartwright illustrated them.
Okay.
And she's a very prolific children's illustrator here in Alaska.
Yeah. So both the Danger the Dog, Yard Cat, and Storm Runner, both about the race in different
ways.
Well,
the cat, yeah. The cat one is the almost true story of my cat that lives with all the dogs. And, you know, part of it's true, of course, but he didn't really lead the dog team in the Iditarod. But,
okay. You know. I haven't read it. I don't remember reading it.
Yeah.
And those had good sales both in and outside of the state.
Yeah. And the Storm Run is used in schools. You know, like, I mean, so many teachers use the Iditarod in classrooms. Like, they actually have a whole teachers' convention twice a year up at the Iditarod for teachers that follow it and study it, and they do a Teacher on the Trail Award every year, and a teacher goes up. I think Wells Fargo's doing that. I'm not sure. But, yeah, that connection, it's just amazing. I mean, it's a long time since I won the Iditarod. I'm getting letters all the time still from kids. Oh, I dressed up as you for Women's History Month, and they send me a little picture, and, you know, and they've read my book, Storm Run, you know. So that's kind of fun. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, have you thought about other kids' ones or just books in general? I know you said you're a slow writer, but...
Oh, I kind of wonder.
What are you working on now?
I'd rather, well, you know, again, just kind of more just my experiences of, you know, dog mushing over the years and trying to maybe just capture the, you know, what Alaska was like when I first moved up here. But I don't know. My problem is it's like, can I sit at the computer and write, or should I go out and run another team of dogs? And guess which one wins?
You mean just exercising them? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we just go run around for fun anymore, but... So love to do it.
You're not concentrating on the computer. Well, besides books, what's left on your bucket list? What other projects do you see on the horizon? Or how long, much longer do you think you'll be in Juneau?
I'm just enjoying life. You know, it took me a long time to kind of find a balance. Like, it's pretty intense running the Iditarod, you know, and being a professional athlete and transiting over into kind of normal life. So... I just tend to focus on how can I enjoy normal life, you know, and then the things I enjoy doing are, you know, also going to visit family and, you know, taking the odd vacation. And I enjoy being at my place in Homer with my dogs, and I'm trying to do music and some artwork and, you know, spend a little time with nieces and nephews and my old mom. And I don't know, just living, just enjoying life.
Oh, music and art. Anything specific that...
I like playing guitar. I like singing. I do beadwork. I'm waiting for the berries to come out because I'm a berry-picking fool, you know. And I just love doing things that are outside. I'm just trying to stay healthy so I can run dogs till I'm a zillion years old, too. So, you know.
That's the
doing
goal.
Doing Qigong every day and all that. So, yeah.
Cool. Maybe. Please, you come on the show tonight. And,
cool.
Tell a little bit of your story. If people want more information, they want to write to you. I know I went to your website, but...
Libby,
I don't remember.
LibbyRiddles.com, you know.
LibbyRiddles.com.
So it's got some information on it.
You also have a wiki site for those who want to look for your bio. I think that's pretty cool. Most people don't.
Well, I didn't even know that till tonight. You said you looked it up, so.
Yeah, Wikipedia. I think people have made it when you... No, just kidding.
Oh, man. Well, nice to know that you're from Valdez. I love Valdez. That's a neat place, too. Besides, we love it because they actually get even more snow than we do in Homer when we're buried. But
like we were saying, I think it was the second record year for a lot of those towns.
The winter. It's cold summer this year, too, but I'm looking forward to catching some of that celebration going on this weekend.
I know.
Very
actually,
cool.
Tonight.
Yep.
Hoping to stop over there after the show's done tonight.
Yeah, super.
So thanks again, Libby Riddles. She was the first woman to win the Iditarod sled dog race in Alaska in 1985. You can find more information at LibbyRiddles.com. And next interview tonight will be Colette Costa, local celebrity. You can get more information on Colette by just Googling her, really, and going to Gold Town Nick. She is currently the manager there. And I'm going to leave you before we leave this portion of the show with a song, Lonely at the Top by Colette Costa, which is from her album You Can't Blame a Girl. So listen to that song, and Colette Costa will be up next here on the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrienne Lopez. Take care.
For me.
Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrian Lopez broadcasting here on KTOO News Juno, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned in the second half of the show tonight. Thanks again to Libby Riddles. Great interview there in the first half. Up next, we'll be talking with famous Colette Costa, who is here in the studio with us tonight. And I've got quite a bio for Colette, so stay be patient. Colette was born in Detroit and raised in a big family. She's the quiet one, she says. She came from a pretty traditional upbringing, suburbia, boring, and hated Michigan since she was a kid.
I did not know you were going to be reading that bio. So all of you from Michigan, I do not hate Michigan. I love Michigan.
Yeah.
And
good.
People from it.
And Wayne State University, shout out, in Detroit was where she went to school for way too long. Came up to work in Pelican, so that's where we'll go into this a little bit later. She got a job on the Scow, loved it, worked 5 summers there, and then kept coming back. She started singing with some local yahoos. You want to say anything on that one?
They know who they are.
Nothing too organized, just music parties in traditional Alaska style. She worked at Pelican Cold Storage, commercial fished, worked at the cafe, Brown Bar and Rosie's Bar. She finished school and took all her money, went to Europe, traveling around. She came back to Alaska where she couldn't get a job in Pelican, so she came to Juneau. I'll leave out the commentary there. She left for 3 months, came back in February. She did her first folk fest, started singing with Lunch Meat and Pimientos. Is that the right pronunciation in Spanish?
Yeah, it's the Haynes version of Pimientos.
Okay.
It's the Pimentos.
Oh, the Pimentos. Okay. I don't know them, but who inspired her? These people inspired her to create the first boardwalk boogie, which is a way to go out to Pelican and throw a party. After 10 years that ran its course, she opened the diner, ran its course, and now she's working at Goldtown Theater, operating that, like all cool things in Juneau.
Wow.
So that's up to the present.
Wow. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I had lunch this afternoon. I'm going to get a haircut later.
Great.
That's pretty much, that's into the future. So, done.
Well, that's the last question I was going to ask you.
Done in 5 minutes.
What's on the horizon?
Later.
I guess we can start backwards in the interview. But I would like to start with Pelican just because I've been there and I love it. And I think it's a neat place for someone
awesome.
To go, not just to Juneau first, but you flew all the way and landed there.
Yeah.
My question is about expectations. What did you have before and then how did they change afterwards?
Well, when you're 18 hours from I-75 to working in the slime line, there's not a lot of processing time other than processing fish. It was pretty shocking. Honestly, and that's, I've been going to school to Detroit in the city in Detroit for 4 solid years and hadn't done much else, and then I went a little crazy one day and I've been doing that since, and I just had to get well, my car got stolen. I had 3 crappy jobs. I was going to school full time, and no car in Detroit is it's death.
Really?
And I have to get out of here and be somewhere where my priorities were. I didn't need a car. And I could make money without spending money. And
Pelican did that.
It was the whole thing was very weird. But basically Pelican was the first place that called me back. I called a bunch of places in Alaska. I picked out 3 towns that sounded fun. One was Kodiak. That's a cute name. And one was somewhere else in the southeast. I think it was Petersburg.
Okay.
And I was like, Pelican, that sounds like a neat little place. And I just, and I had this book with all these businesses, and I called them. And I don't know if people still do this or not, if people are still this dumb. If you're listening and you're thinking of doing this, talk to me. And I just thought, well, this could be a really fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Go to Alaska and do something with fish. And I called these places, and Pelican was the first place that called me back. And I said, hey, just, how do you do this? And she's like, can you be here in 5 days? I was like, well, I'm in school, but can you be here in 10 days? Okay. And I was like, how do I get there? She's like, fly to Seattle. Seattle, fly to Juneau. Wait for us.
I'll give you a card.
And then every step of the way, the planes kept getting smaller.
Mm.
And then when I got into Juneau, they loaded us in a van. And I thought, oh, maybe we're going to drive there. And they just drove us to a pond. And I thought, well, maybe we got to pick something up. And there was this like rat with wings. And they're like, get on that. I was like, yeah, no. You know it's a bad sign when they ask you how much you weigh before you get into a plane. Like at that point, and of course, you know, as any smart woman, I lied. I'm like, yeah, I come in at about, you know, 110, which is clearly not true. Like one of my thighs is 110. And they're like, okay, and they're writing that down. I'm like, come on, man. Like, if my life depends on me being honest about my weight, we are all screwed. And that was terrifying.
Was the weather decent?
It was a beautiful. My foggy memory is that it was beautiful.
That's good.
And then we landed, and my very first thought was, "You've got to be joking me." I was like, "Oh well, the city must be around the corner. That must be over behind that mountain side there." And they were getting ready at that point. They don't do these. They used to have derbies. They used to have halibut derbies, black cod derbies.
Yeah.
And, well, they don't do them anymore. But it was a pretty intense time. And everyone is super focused on getting their gear ready or gearing up to start processing a lot of fish. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was, like, I stepped out of this plane onto a dock because there's no road. There's no airport. And everything smelled like fish. And I swear to God, my first thought was that they imported the entire set of Popeye to the side of a mountain and stuck it here. And are these people seriously living here? Because this is ridiculous. And
did you share that with people on the plane? Were they all in the same situation?
Well, I was with one other girl who came with me, this friend of mine, and she grew up in Detroit, so she became mute at that point. And this really nice girl who used to work at the cold storage met us, and she was all, you know, kind of what would be considered dolled up, you know, and that she was not wearing slimy orange ugly gear. "Oh, come on up. I'll show you the plant. You guys, come on. Welcome to Pelt. We'll get you a lunch." And she was so nice, and she took us to the store, and she's like, "Oh, well, this is going to be your uniform," and we are trying on these big, heavy, unwieldy plastic coats. And I was like, "You know, this is fun, but seriously, you can't do anything in this." And big plastic pants. And then she tricked us. And she's like, "Let me just show you what the cold storage looks like." And it was, you know, they have those heavy plastic things that hang in front of the door. And it was like, and then when you pull them out, it was like the sixth inner ring of Dante's Inferno on the other side. You opened it, and it was just like yelling and you know, forklifts and
chaos.
Fish and chaos, and someone screaming about sweetmeat and fish being moved and she basically tricked us into getting onto the slime line and working. And she's like, "Well, step up." She literally is like, "Well, just step up there, see what it looks like." And this is like a full moving slime line of like thousands of pounds of fish just moving and moving and moving. And everybody looks exactly the same because they're all wearing a baseball hat and orange uglies and rubber boots and rubber gloves holding a knife. And we jump up on this table, and I stood up there and I was like, "Yeah, huh." And I was like, "Okay, this is cool." And I turned around to get them. We're up on these platforms, these like 4-foot-high platforms. And when you're only 5'2", that means that you have to get up them by crawling. So I literally crawled up into this platform. And I looked around, and she was gone.
She's disappeared.
Gone. And I was like, And I looked at some guy who was, we shared a table, this guy who was at the table. And I was like, "Hey, do you know where so-and-so went?" And he was, "Where so-and-so went?" And he was like, "Why do I care? Get to work. Get a fish." I was like, "No, I just got here. Just got here. Slept in the airport last night."
Yeah.
And then someone at the front of the line just started. There used to be this woman. God bless Kiki. Kiki worked at the front of the line. Kiki was about 6'12", and she came in at an easy 360, 370. And she was like she was the sweetest girl and like a prison guard on the line. And
wow.
And she just stood up and she just said words I can't say on the radio. And she was just like, "Clean your sweet meat and get a fish." And I was just terrified. And that was my first day at work.
That's
and we worked
intense.
Until midnight.
Jeez. And you did that.
And we had a 6 a.m. call the next day. And we had that for 3 weeks straight.
Wow, Colette.
It was awesome.
That's intense.
And after about 2 weeks, I was like, "Okay, this sucks in like 5 different ways. The first of which is I can't move my hands. The second of which is I am a complete wimp, and that's cool."
It's good to admit it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm good in Detroit, but this is not working out for me. And
that doesn't work out for most Alaskans. No. That's what they bring people from.
Exactly.
Away places.
And I looked around and I realized after I was there for, you know, I got to know a couple people. It was like your first tour of duty. Nobody talks to you for like 2 weeks because they know you're probably not going to last. And then I finally talked to people. Nobody there was actually from Pelican, because they were all too smart. They had real jobs. They were like the teachers and everyone there was. There were more like master's degrees on that slime line than I've ever seen in my life. And I was like, master's in philosophy, master's in English, master's in reading. And I was like, that's awesome. It's what you get when you have a film degree.
Yes, actually, that's a question from one of your fans who wrote in to ask you about why you majored in film.
My fans can't write.
Well, somebody wanted to know that, which wasn't in your bio at Wayne State University, film, which maybe relates to what you're doing now.
Yeah, I started going to school to be a lawyer, and then I realized I wasn't that much of an idiot. So I don't mean that. For all you lawyers. Sorry, Mike. It's like a lot of people, I started going to school because that's what you do. And the only thing I wanted to do was watch movies, and they happened to have a degree. Wayne State is this sort of mini ghetto college in Detroit with like 40,000 students.
Wow.
And everybody commutes to it. So and they have like great pharmacy programs, and they have really great, they have a couple great acting programs. Don't have a great film program, but they had one. Oh. And so I was like, well, I like doing that. I'll do that for a while. And they had, you know, like Lily Tomlin went there. And
really?
Sam Raimi, who made Darkman and one of the Spider-Men, he went there. He went to school there. In fact, I went to take out some equipment. You know, you had to sign out filmmaking equipment. Mm. And I looked back in the roster, and there was Sam Raimi. He had checked out the same equipment 30 years before. So there's some people. But by the time I was there, it was kind of a slapdash program, and it was interdisciplinary, which is a university's way of saying we can't really give you a degree in this because we don't have enough classes. So if you take all these different classes, we'll get you one. And it was basically just a BA, but it was focused on film and filmmaking and interdisciplinary stuff. And that's really what I love doing more than fishing.
It's interdisciplinary, yeah. It is. Lots of things, which is... Yeah, there's so much to ask you, Colette, so I'm going to keep pushing through.
Just head down and power through, Adrian. That's the best way to deal with me.
Costa's Diner, you know, I wasn't lucky enough. I just moved here a year ago to go there. But I'd heard about it, and maybe there's not people... We were just talking before the show about Celebration. Not everybody in Juneau's heard about it. Maybe not everybody in Juneau's heard about Colette's or Costa's Diner.
Probably for good measure.
Very unique idea. So the questions are, why do you make customers handwrite their orders? How do you make a Monte Cristo, which was the best thing on the menu, and your obsession with Tom Jones, because he was on your diner menu at one point.
Wow. How much time do we have? I mean, TJ is a whole other show. So,
TJ, Tom Jones,
yeah.
Okay.
TJ. That's her.
Well, we could do a follow-up on him.
We'll do a follow-up on Tom.
Okay. We'll have him on the show.
So, you know, during the time that I had the diner for about 4 years down there, and... One of the times that I had it, I was making a trip back to Detroit, and while I was going to be in Detroit, I was going to go see Tom Jones. And so I closed down for like a week and had this giant sign I made for the window that said, gone to Detroit to marry Tom Jones. Be back, whatever. Please address me as Mrs. Tom Jones. In that time that I was gone, I had a friend who was kind of doing some stuff for me there. She said that somebody came by the diner, you know, and was like, oh, yeah, I'm curious about this sign here. Oh, that's, you know, Colette, and she's blah, blah, blah. And that guy's like, oh, that's really funny because I used to be Tom Jones's drummer.
No way.
And I was just curious if he was getting married.
How old is the guy now?
He was, you know, 50-something, but he totally left his card. And I called him when I got back. And I was like, yeah, just letting you know that it didn't work out with me and TJ. And it's a bummer, but...
So you actually talked to the drummer?
Yeah, it was
that's neat.
Really crazy. You never know who's going to come through this wicked little town.
Yeah. Wow.
Basically, the whole premise of the diner was that the more work that you did as a customer, the less work I had to do, and then everyone was happier. And I figured if you write down your order, then I don't have to make a menu, which I don't want to do, and B, you're going to get exactly what you want, and I'm not going to have to ask you any questions. Like...
Nice.
Yeah. And so the rule is if it wasn't written down, you were going to get what I gave you.
Okay.
Which worked out pretty well, too.
People just said, make whatever you want.
It cut down on a lot of conversation of just unnecessary stuff.
Okay.
And basically, you did most of the work there.
Okay.
You know, and sometimes you'd wash dishes.
And the model worked okay?
It worked really well for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time playing cribbage. Yeah, that was wonderful for me. But okay. It was a fun model. I don't think... I could do it again. I don't know if it could be done again. It could by someone, but...
Do you think you could train other restaurants to do this, Molly?
You know what's funny is the week that I was shutting down, a new place was opening in Seattle, and the front page of the Seattle Times was this article on this new coffee shop that was opening in downtown, and they didn't have a price structure, and they didn't have a register, and they had at the end of the counter, they had a box with just a little, like a slit in top, and you would just put money in. And nothing had prices, and you could order whatever you wanted. And it was just a coffee shop, and it was doing doing gangbusters.
Wow.
And
so they stole it from you.
And I was like, yeah, first of all, they stole it from me. Second of all, I'm not on the front of the Seattle Times.
Should be.
I did actually have some prices, but I just kind of felt like diners are for small towns. We have a small town, and part of the whole mentality is that, you know, it's made for a small community, and it's not that I trust people, but I think that if people think that you trust them, they act trustworthy, and
true,
and they value that more than they value the food, because the food wasn't that good. And you know, and generally, you know, there were days when I would have free days, and it was everything was free, and I never made as much money as I did on free days.
Really?
Yeah. Which was dumb. I should have had free days every day.
That's pretty awesome, Colette. So Costa's Diner. So that's
check
done
Tom
with
Jones,
that.
Check.
let's see.
Monte Cristo. Don't ask. You need a deep fryer.
Oh, the boogie. The boogie. That's another one that we got to hit on.
We're already in the boogie.
Because we have we got to go backwards, right? The boogie was before the diner, or it's kind of at the same time.
Before, during.
All right. So we've got Boardwalk
that
Boogie.
The boogie was we did that for 10 years, and that was sure fun. That's one of those things that afterwards you're like, it's like when you have this massive hangover and you're like, I'm never drinking again. And then like next year you drink again. That's kind of what the boogie was like. It was like giving birth and like, God, I hate kids. Let's go have another one. It was like that. In fact, so that originated with myself and two of my friends, Flash and Carol, who lived here as well. And, well, Flash still lives here. And see, everything that I do here, have done here, at some point ties back to Pelican. And when I came here from Pelican, when I went to Pelican to work for a summer, the cold storage had closed down. I didn't want a commercial fish anymore. Yeah. There was nothing going on. And I just gotten a film degree, and they were shooting Limbo here in town. So this is back in 98. And I was like, oh, my God, I just wrote my senior dissertation on John Sayles. Clearly, this is what I'm meant to do. That's God cool. has shown me the way. So I was like, I got to do this. So I moved to Juneau, and I was actually living on Flash's boat in the harbor and trying to get on this film crew, which was an epic disaster. It was just like, if it had been a movie, it couldn't have been better, worse scripted. Like, I could not crack a nut on that for anything.
Really?
And I basically spent all summer just being this weird, like,
this extra
weird
wannabe?
Like, yeah, like following them. And it was sad and pathetic and hopeless. And then at the end, I was like, okay, well, my life is ruined. That clearly wasn't what God wanted, so or the universe. So now what?
You didn't meet John or get to talk to him?
I literally met him once and shook his hand, and he was very busy doing something else.
Because he lives here. Somebody said they saw him in a 4th of July parade one time.
Yeah. And that kind of was simultaneous with, that was happening kind of around the same time as Folk Festival.
Okay.
Because they were here like April, May, whatever. So I also went to my first Folk Festival that year. And... which was, you know, we have a pretty strong musical tradition in Pelican. You know, we had a lot of really good musicians there. We would get together during the few off hours you had, and we would, you know, just have dinners and pick tunes and play music. And every once in a while, we'd go to the community hall and play for everybody. And it was just real small town stuff. And when I was here for Folk Festival, I saw a lot of the fishermen that I knew, and you know, it already felt like a little bit of a community. And my friends, Flash and Carol, got married on Folkfest stage that year. It was kind of a big deal that year. And nobody knew. It was like this big surprise. So he went up to do his set, and then all of a sudden, another friend of ours who was a magistrate came on, and everyone was like, what the hell? And they got married on the stage. And then afterwards, they said, hey, there's this awesome band playing at the Hangar from Haines called, you're going to love them. They're like a Dixieland jazz band called the Pimentos from Haines. And I was like, nobody plays Dixieland jazz. And we dragged over there, and sure enough, there was this like six-piece Dixieland jazz band. And it's like, this is awesome. And I, you know, I'd always loved that kind of music, and I knew all their songs, and we danced all night. And it was a blast. And literally, like a couple weeks later, we were hanging out at Flash and Carol's, and we're like, man, we need to get the Pimentos to come to Pelican and just have a party. Like, yeah, let's take the gloves off and do this right. And that was kind of how that was born. And it took us a year to get our act together. But within that year, basically, Flash, God bless him, Flash has sort of connected me with them. And they, for better and for worse, took me on to be the lead singer for their band.
Oh, wow.
Which was awesome.
I mean,
and then we still do gigs occasionally together. And okay, they do a lot up in Haines. They don't come down here very often. But
And you put out a record with him as well, a CD.
Yes and no.
Or yeah, 12 songs recorded.
Yeah.
There was an article in Juno Empire about
that.
Yeah,
let's just...
Never mind.
Moving on. Right now. No, he put out... Eric Holly is a fantastic banjo player, and which those words don't generally go together. There's other words to describe banjo players, but we'll use that one for now. Anyway, he put out a great little CD I sang a couple tunes on. It was reviewed in a jazz magazine, and the quote they said was that Choette Kosa's vocal singing was both adequate and occasionally inventive.
Well, adequate.
Yeah, so that became like we put on our posters, super adequate singing.
That's great.
That was born, and we rented a boat and dragged them to Pelican and had like 20 people come along for the ride.
And that lasted, I mean, is there an alum Facebook page, all the people who had gone?
God.
The pictures?
God this was pre-Facebook. Because by the end, I would specify, because we had certain things in there, like we had a dirty song contest that Facebook was sort of invented during the boogie, and so I started having to introduce it as a Facebook-free event. In fact, it was supposed to be a photo-free event, but I'm just saying, Adrian, photos exist, and that's my retirement. So, there are a lot of people that went to the boogie who don't remember what they did.
There you go.
I've got photographic evidence.
And you can blackmail them.
And I can't wait.
Glad I wasn't there. Nothing will jeopardize my career, you know. what do I ask? Female dancers for your music acts. Fletcher wanted to know why I've never been asked.
Oh, just throwing that one in there. Well, la-di-da.
The hometown honeys. Honeys.
Honeys.
Honeys. Honeys. He wrote that down. Okay.
Yeah, well, again, he can't spell, so good. He's a government employee. He doesn't have to spell. He has someone do that for him.
And so your artistic prejudice. Here's one he was asking about. Your artistic prejudices keep you from showing certain kinds of movies at Gold Town.
I don't know what he means. My artistic prejudice keeps me from showing, like, crappy movies, does he mean?
Yeah.
I think that's what he means.
This was kind of in a package of ones. He also asked about a movie marathon. What will you absolutely not watch, and what do you watch?
I'll watch anything.
Okay.
I mean, almost, except I can't stand Reese Witherspoon.
Ugh.
Sorry, I don't mean to point her out. I think what he's alluding to is that I can be a film snob, which is only half true, considering my two favorite movies are Jaws and The Poseidon Adventure.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure how that fits in. But we are primarily in art house cinema. And I don't use the word cinema to be a snob, to say that we're not a movie theater. That's fine, we are. But we're an art house theater, and we show alternative venues. You know, we primarily hit the art house circuit, indies, foreigns, documentaries.
Okay.
I love Hollywood movies. I adore them. I can't, with, you know, because of what we are, because of the numbers we get, we can't usually get them. When we can get them, they're usually on video. Mm. They've already been shown for a while. And we don't have, you know, we don't have the kind of theater that can adequately show something like The Avengers. I mean, yeah. We have a cute little theater that shows, you know, really good movies, but we don't have 16 speakers and TXX just deafening you sound. We just and I'm not interested in that, because you can see that anywhere.
Yeah.
And there are about 14,000 other movies that come out in a given year that are, I'm going to use the word better in my opinion, but that are just as good and should have an audience as well. And I think that there's a lot of other people who feel that way too.
You feel an itch, an important itch.
Yeah, there. And they may not even know those movies are out there. I mean, sometimes the most frustrating thing is when I'm showing. Like right now, I'm showing this movie Headhunters, which is, it's a foreign film. It's not an arty film. It is super high action. It's fairly violent. It's a lot of action, a lot of gunplay. I mean, it's a perfect American film, except it's Norwegian. Except they're making an American version of it right now that will be out next summer, and it will be a huge summer hit.
Interesting.
The difference is this one you have to read a little bit. Not that much, because a lot of it is people running and shooting. and it doesn't have Keanu Reeves in it or whatever. But, no, you know, I mean,
do you get recommendations from people? There must be people out there that see something.
I love recommendations, because that tells me that I know one person is going to be at that movie. And if they're recommending it, they're obviously interested in something. And they're going to tell everyone else they know to come see it too. And so I've got that hook already, which helps. Sometimes they're just not good enough, quite frankly. They're not the kind of movie that you can really show for a whole weekend or anything, especially in the summer when you're competing with the sun and whales and everything else.
Yeah.
But no, I did a little... You know, a birthday marathon for my birthday, and I think we watched everything from the ridiculous to the sublime. I mean, we had everything from, you know, B movies to A movies. What was Z movies? What would be the opposite of B movies?
Okay, we'll have to recommend one sometime. Because a few years ago, I was doing this show down in Chile, and I interviewed these producers that did not think they'd do very well at Sundance, but their movie ended up winning.
Wow.
And it was based on the whole culture of having maids, and the Nana, it's called.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, it was just a really neat one. I always like to promote their work when I'm out there.
Yeah, and I love, I love indie, I mean, you know, I love John Sayles stuff. He hasn't been making really great films lately, unfortunately, so I didn't pick up the last one he did. But, and also I have to kind of weigh that against Juno and Who Lives Here and what their interest. I mean, there was this, probably one of the best movies I've seen in the last 10 years. It came out a year and a half ago. It was called The City of Life and Death. It's a Chinese film, and it was about the World War II incident of the Rape of Nanking when the Japanese invaded what was then the capital of China. They just did an American version called Broken Flowers with Christian Bale, which is not nearly as poignant or as subtle or as... And this movie is... It's the finest film I've seen in 10 years. I couldn't pick it up. It would not have sold.
Wow.
And you know, probably for good reason, it was a really hard movie, but it was stunning. It was really beautiful, and I recommend it to everyone.
Cool. Great. Almost out of time.
TikTok,
so that
TikTok.
The first question was about your next project. Anything? Did you think of anything in the last half hour?
The last half hour, other than getting my hair cut? Actually, the one thing I'm super excited about that I've got a lot of groundwork laid on is a combination of my two of my three favorite things, not including food, which is music and movies. And I'm gonna be launching a series of silent films with live accompanied music, which is really quite, it's not nothing I invented. They're doing it all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But a silent film was always my favorite genre. I kind of specialize in silent film. And we, as you know, have an incredible amount of musical talent in this town.
Oh, yeah.
And I just had a meeting last night with Jack Fontanella and Banghart and Eric Chadwell and Sergey, and we're gonna start with, you know, I think some Buster Keaton films and with live accompanied kind of old time, and I want to do like a whole monthly series, one a month, and
well,
I think
collect.
That's gonna
Best
be really fun
with that.
Thank you, Adrian. Yeah, and thank you, Adrian, for doing this show. I think it's a great idea, and God knows why you asked me, but
because you have a lot to talk about.
Best of luck to you.
And you're exactly what this show is about. And for those who don't know, I'll be taking a little bit of a break. I'm relocating to Washington, D.C., but I also want to continue with the show and be doing it back there and interviewing amazing Alaskans that are there or passing through or still doing phone interviews with people. So stay tuned either through Facebook or on the K2 website, and I'll let you know when I have the next show coming up. And thanks here in the studio to Martha Moore.
Yay!
It wouldn't have been possible without her this past almost year to put on the show. So thanks to her, as well as Susan, who came in once in a while and helped do great things to make it possible. So thanks again. Take care, everybody.
Hotel, my mama.